Welcome to Stories After Midnight, home of the greatest black and white cat imaginable named Gary. Today we're going to be reading a story called I Ended My True Crime Podcast After Meeting My Biggest Fan. This story is from Reddit and it's by Box Goblin. I hope you enjoy it, and a huge shout out to my patrons for making this episode possible. Let's get started. I ran a successful true crime podcast called Eidolon. It covered missing person cases from legendary stories on Amelia Earhart to relatively unknown cases from the recent news. Recently, I told my 100,000 plus followers that I was stepping away to focus on other projects, namely my day job as an audio engineer. I told my friends that I was taking a mental health break. All the interviews with grieving parents, friends, and lovers with no closure had chipped away at my soul. I needed to reset, rediscover the beauty in this world, to forget the darkness that lurks beneath its surface. But the main reason I shuttered Eidolon, the reason I deleted all my audio files and all contact sheets, the reason I promised myself I would never touch the true crime genre again, was due to one person, Charnel Sam. According to his scant Patreon profile, Sam was located somewhere in the US and had plenty of discretionary income, donating to various true crime podcasts via the site. But he gave the most money to mine, having donated over $5,000 to Eidolon for the past 2 years. Usually through regular $200 payments, Charnel Sam was my biggest fan. My online conversations with Sam were brief and professional. I sent him a nice personalized thank you message each time he donated, and would announce his username at the top of my credits after each episode. Most of the time, my messages went unanswered, but on occasion, he would respond with a single cryptic sentence. It was always the same. Light floods the grateful frame, catching moments gifted by time. I had no idea what that meant or what it had to do with my podcast. It might have been part of his online signature, perhaps some famous quote missing an attribution. But if that were the case, why only send the attribution and not an actual message? I never thought much about it. I was just happy to receive such large and consistent donations. If Charnel Sam wanted to send me a cryptic quote now and then, he was more than welcome to do it. But everything changed a few weeks ago when I received this. Hey Brian, I have some information that I think could help solve the Bertrand Hikers mystery. I'd recently re-aired an episode on the Bertrand Hikers, two teenage girls who mysteriously vanished while hiking in the Bertrand Nature Preserve in northwestern Georgia, an area not far from my home in the Atlanta suburbs. The case was one of my most popular stories and the main one that launched my podcast. The disappearance of Heather Simmons and Alicia Gunderson is one of those local legends that everyone I grew up with knew about, but never received much national attention. As such, it was a relatively unknown missing person case when I recorded my first podcast episode on it. Though the girls were teenagers, they were not the attractive, white, blonde teens that received most of the media's attention. Heather was slightly overweight for her age, with lots of bushy, curly hair. The popular girls at her school picked on her, calling her Shamu. Alicia was pretty, but still an outsider in the small town of Bertrand. She was biracial with a white Norwegian father and a Nigerian mother. Her family had recently moved to America from Bergen, Norway, and she spoke broken English. There were kids at school who jokingly referred to her as a dark elf. Both girls were 16 at the time of their disappearance. They became friends at Bertrand High, where they shared a homeroom. They played soccer and loved bands like Nirvana and the Smashing Pumpkins. They stayed up late watching John Carpenter movies and binging on popcorn and Kit Kats. They got straight A's in all their classes. They dressed up as Beetlejuice and Catwoman for Halloween 1 year. They were inseparable. Alicia was planning to go to Harvard Med and become a dentist when she grew up. And Heather wanted to be a wildlife photographer for National Geographic. More on that later. They weren't popular at school, but they had loving families, and they always had each other. On October 17th, 1998, Heather and Alicia biked from their homes to the Bertrand Nature Preserve, a massive park covering 80 square miles of dense forest that blanketed the low-lying mounds of the Appalachian foothills. Witnesses at the visitor center saw them arrive around noon that Saturday. They told their parents they were just going for a short hike up to Bald Head Rock, a scenic lookout about 3 miles from the parking lot where they'd chained up their bikes. Tons of people hiked the trail on the weekends, and the girls were planning to be home well before nightfall. In fact, Heather and Alicia were planning to see the movie Practical Magic with Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman later that night at 8 p.m. But 8 p.m. came and went, and the girls' bikes remained untouched in the parking lot. No one had seen them there. No one had heard from them. By then, Heather and Alicia's parents were frantic. They had already called 911, and a couple of officers had gone out to Bertrand Nature Preserve to search for the missing teens. All they found were the bikes still chained up outside the nature center. Over the following weeks, a huge search party combed the mountains. Hundreds of volunteers and SAR personnel checked behind every tree, looking within every bush, and turned over every rock searching for clues, and they found nothing. Eventually, the news reports stopped. The missing posters on telephone poles and outside shops started to fade, fall off, or were even pasted over with flyers advertising local bands or politicians running for upcoming elections. As sad as it was, the case would have disappeared into total obscurity were it not for a strange discovery almost 2 years later. In 2000, a local Boy Scout troop was camping in the Bertrand Preserve when one of the kids stumbled upon a rusted single-lens reflex SLR camera half buried in the dirt near their campsite. He didn't know it then, but the boy had just discovered Heather's most prized possession. She'd taken the camera with her on that fateful day in October 2 years prior. When the authorities developed the camera's film roll, they uncovered a breakdown of that day's events. The first half of the pictures are known colloquially as the day shots. There were shots of Alicia silhouetted against the afternoon sun, and others showing her disappearing into an endless forest. Heather had a good eye for composition, and she knew how to make the most of natural lighting. It's sad looking at the day shots now, because you can see the raw talent of a burgeoning artist finding her voice. She would have made a great photographer had she come home that day. Another thing people noticed was the way Heather captured Alicia's beauty in the photos. The way she brought out her best friend's hazel green eyes and accentuated her sharp facial bone structure using a juxtaposition of light and shadow. There was already speculation among their classmates that Heather had a crush on Alicia. Some even believed they were a couple, though there was no evidence the two girls had ever hooked up. Some speculated that Heather may have killed Alicia after she'd rejected Heather's advances, and then Heather killed herself. But there was no evidence of this from eyewitnesses or the photos themselves. What was clear from the day shots was that both girls had a zest for life. They were having fun and goofing off. There were even some forced perspective photos of Heather and Alicia pretending to eat a downed tree. These pictures contradicted one of the authorities' earlier theories regarding the girls' disappearance, that they might have taken their own lives due to depression. It was a reasonable theory, given that both girls were bullied at school and had no real friends outside of each other. But they never left a note, and neither their parents nor their classmates felt they were depressed. What really got the authorities' attention was a second set of photos on the roll. They called them the night shots. These photos were time-stamped on October 31, 1998, a full 2 weeks after the girls were reported missing. They were taken in the middle of the night with a camera flash for 30 minutes. Creepiest of all was the subject matter. The night shots were almost entirely random images of the forest, tree limbs, bushes, rocks. There were no signs of civilization in them, just endless darkness beyond the foliage caught in the camera flash. Many of the pictures were out of focus, showing random green and black blurs. The most famous photo was a close-up of what appeared to be the back of Heather's head. Her curly hair filled a frame. Amongst those bushy strands was a dark red streak, blood. The photos on Heather's camera were never officially released to the public. They remained sealed in evidence until sometime in the late 2000s, possibly 08 or 09. And that's when someone leaked them to a now defunct true crime forum called Missing Ink, and they eventually found their way to Reddit. Once people saw the photos online, the Bertrand Hiker's case took on a whole new dimension. Suddenly, there were dozens, then hundreds, then thousands of posts discussing the case and providing theories behind the girl's disappearance. All of them were centered around the night shots. There was a popular theory that the girls had gone off the trail and become lost, and the night shots were a way of signaling rescuers with the camera flash. There was a massive search of the Bertrand Nature Preserve on Halloween 1998. The SAR personnel were likely close to the girls at that time. Another popular theory positioned that the girls became incapacitated. Perhaps they had got lost and then fallen off the trail in the dark. Both girls were too injured to hike out. Many believed Heather had died from her fall, and Alicia used the camera to see her friend and get a bearing on where they had landed. Some armchair sleuths even believed Alicia had killed Heather, given the close-up of Heather's bloodied scalp, though there was no clear motive for such a crime. Jealousy? A verbal fight that had escalated into something physical. Perhaps Alicia pushed Heather, causing her only friend to accidentally fall to her death. Alicia, overcome with guilt and worried that she would be arrested for murder, then took her own life, but not before providing a confession in the form of random photos. I didn't believe any such theories. Hi Sam, thanks again for all your support. I'd love to see what info you have on Bertrand. An hour later, he sent this reply. Would you mind meeting up at Coffeeland on the corner of Weston and Whitsett? This caught me off guard. When I received Sam's message, I was staying at a hotel in Atlanta for a true crime convention. I was there to run a panel on missing persons cases. A quick Google search revealed that Coffeeland was not far from my hotel. Sam's reply came moments after. I know you're in town for True Crime Con. Brian? A tall, elderly man stood up from his table at the coffee shop. He was balding with silvery hair and a trimmed beard. He wore a nice sweater vest, khaki pants, and horn-rimmed glasses. The man reminded me of a college professor. Yes, I said, shaking his offered hand. It was soft and smooth, like he used a lot of moisturizers. My name's Samuel, he said. Please, have a seat. Can I get you anything? We both got coffees and returned to our table. The tiny shop was busy with locals coming and going. Students and amateur screenwriters sat at the nearby tables, their heads buried in their laptops. I must say, I really loved your take on the Bertrand Hiker's mystery, Sam said. It's the only one that I think is close to the truth. Thanks, I said. My podcast presented a different take from all the others that covered Heather and Alicia's disappearance. I concluded that someone had kidnapped and likely murdered the girls, and the night shots were taken by the suspect. But the evidence I presented was not in the night shots themselves. Rather, it was in the day shots, the ones most people just glossed over. A good friend of mine is a professional photographer. I had asked her to examine the leaked photos, hoping she might shed some light, both figuratively and literally, on the night shots. I wanted her to brighten the pictures without losing too much information and reveal something or someone lurking in the darkness just beyond the camera flash. She did just that, but all it revealed was more empty forest. There wasn't anything more to see, she said. The night shots have been pored over hundreds of times online anyway. My friend paused for a moment, but I did take a second look at the daytime photos and there was something strange on 205. Photo 205, named because of its timestamp of 2:05 p.m., was a shot of Alicia and Heather smiling for the camera as they stopped at a lookout point on the way to Bald Head Rock. The camera was likely placed on a rock so it could capture both girls. They appeared happy and carefree in the sunny proto-selfie. The picture captured just how much wilderness was in the Bertrand Nature Preserve. You can see a massive forest stretching for miles and miles behind them. Take a look at the bottom far right, my friend said. I've lightened the shadows in the background. I stared at the location, but all I found were trees. What am I supposed to see? It's right there, between those two trunks. She pointed to a black dot in the far corner. It looked like an oddly shaped stump. What is that? It's a person, she said. My friend showed me another copy of the photo, this one even brighter. The extra exposure had washed out the girls in the foreground completely, but now I could clearly see the human shape standing in the trees below them, watching. The figure was out of focus, so we couldn't make out any details, but it appeared to be a man wearing all black. Oh my God, I gasped. We sent the enhanced photos to the authorities, who thanked us for the new evidence. It was the first break they'd had in the case in over a decade. The discovery made local headlines. Heather and Alicia's families even sent us thank you cards, but ultimately it didn't lead to much. Without any bodies, there was no evidence the girls were kidnapped, and the lurking figure in photo 205 was too grainy to identify. All the forensic analysts could conclude was the suspect's gender, male, and a rough estimate of his height, 6'3". Still, the discovery made my podcast go viral. It was a nice prize after spending months researching the case. "So you think my theory is the closest, huh?" I asked Sam. "That someone kidnapped and likely murdered them?" Sam sipped his coffee. It was getting late and the shop was starting to clear out. "More than that, I think I can prove it." My eyebrows raised. This better not be another conspiracy theory. I'd run across plenty of weirdos in my true crime career. People who believe that missing persons were abducted by aliens or murdered by Bigfoot. Their stories always started semi-sane, but the more they spoke, the stranger things got until you found yourself listening to how one of the 9/11 hijackers was an interdimensional being who traveled from an alternate Earth to stop the lizard people's invasion of Washington. "What proof?" I asked. Sam sat back in his chair and let out a deep breath. "My brother passed away a month ago," he began. He was a handful. Two failed marriages, no kids, no friends, never got along with anyone in the family except me. He was a drunk and a compulsive gambler, screwed over almost everyone in his life. My brother was a hoarder too, spent most of his life roaming the country, working odd jobs in construction and living out of a beat-up RV. When he died, I was stuck with the unenviable task of clearing out all the junk he'd accumulated in his 65 years on this earth. The stench when I opened that RV door made my eyes water. There was so much rotting garbage, mountains of crap. I found 3 rat corpses. 3! I don't know how my brother had stuffed everything into such a small place. Sam sat down his drink. "Anyway, I'm throwing out boxes of this stuff when I come across these old photos, and there's one on top that immediately caught my eye. You know what it was?" I shook my head. Sam reached into his pocket and pulled out a glossy printed photo, the kind you would pick up from a CVS or Walgreens back in the day. It was semi-wrinkled and smudged with grease. As soon as I saw the image, I choked on my Mexican latte. The photo showed Heather and Alicia, and not just any photo. It was a picture taken on the same day they disappeared, on the same trail up to Baldhead Rock. But this was a new photo, not part of the day shots that I'd pored over so many times. In the picture, Heather had her SLR camera slung over her shoulder. As soon as I saw that, I knew the photo wasn't from her camera. "Who took this?" Sam grinned. "My brother." "Are there others?" He nodded. "But I can't show you here." "Why?" Sam sat back in his chair, studying me with pensive eyes. "I need an assurance from you first." "You want money, don't you?" I had armchair investigators ask for payment in exchange for evidence or interviews in the past. I always turned them down. It just felt icky, distasteful. "Why would I ask for that?" Sam looked hurt by my question. "I've given you thousands of dollars." "Sorry, I've had bad experiences," I said, hoping I hadn't ruined the deal. I meant no offense, and I'm very, very grateful for all your donations. I really am. "You don't do this for the money, do you?" Sam asked. "No, of course not," I said, though even at that moment I was reminded of how often I'd hoped I could turn this side hustle into a full-time gig. Running a podcast was a lot of work and money, especially one that involved such heavy research. Not to mention all the logistics involved with interviewing witnesses and loved ones. "I want to bring closure," I said. I'd always felt that the only thing worse than losing a loved one in a violent crime was having that person go missing instead. At least a murder gave you the definite answer. A missing person was like a never-ending haunting, a spirit taunting you with the possibility, however faint, of a miraculous return. "You want the truth," Sam said. "Don't we all?" Sam finished his coffee, then got up to throw it away. "I live not far from here," he said. Sam's house was a modest, one-story, ranch-style bungalow. I immediately noticed an old RV in its driveway as I parked out front. I stared at the rundown vehicle as I walked toward the home's entrance. I'm looking to sell that thing once I finished cleaning it out. Sam was waiting on the front porch to let me in. As soon as I did, I noticed that Sam had brought much of his brother's RV hoard inside. I had to squeeze past stacks of crumpled magazines and cardboard boxes of random junk in the living room. "Sorry about all this," Sam said. "Once I discovered the photos, I decided I needed to do a more thorough investigation of my brother's belongings before throwing them all out." "It's fine," I said. The house was dark and musty. A heaviness lingered in the air. It felt like walking underwater. Sam led me to a kitchen table, the one pristine spot in the house. There, he pulled out a dusty photo album. It was big and black with a leather exterior. I found the rest of his photos in here. The album creaked as he opened it. Inside were pictures of roadside attractions, long stretches of highway, national parks, and random people. It looked like the photo journal of a relentless traveler. There were photos of temperate rainforests in the Pacific Northwest, desert canyons, big cities, rest stops, and lots of forests. Sam stopped as he reached a section with photos of the Appalachian Mountains. "This is where it begins." The first page showed photos of the Bertrand Nature Center and parking lot. I leaned in. There were the girls' bikes tied up outside. Flip, creak. Pictures of the main hiking trail, trees, mountain vistas. Flip, creak. There was the photo of Heather and Alicia, the same one Sam had shown me at Coffeeland. Alongside it were other photos of the girls, some of them smiling for the camera, others where they struck semi-serious poses like they were fashion models. They appeared to be having a great time. "I don't understand," I said, staring. "He took all of these?" "Apparently he'd struck up a friendship with the girls," Sam said. The old man was about to turn the page when he stopped. I instinctively reached out to turn it myself, but Sam kept the pages closed. "Sorry, I need one more assurance from you before I continue." "What's that?" I stepped back, suddenly aware of how close I'd gotten to the old man. "What I'm about to show you is very sensitive. It could do irreparable damage to my family if it ever got out," Sam said, staring into my eyes. I'd never noticed how dark his eyes were. They were a deep brown, almost black, in the low light of his house. "I need you to promise me you'll keep this a secret. You can't tell anyone. Not the cops. Not even the victims' families. No one." "What?" A million little alarm bells rang out in my head. There's something wrong here. Very wrong. I'm sorry. I kept backing away from the old man. I need to... and accidentally stumbled into a tower of magazines, falling onto the dusty floor. Sam shot up from the table. How could he move that fast? Within seconds, the old man was looming over me, offering his hand to help me up. His spindly fingers danced in the air like spider legs. I crawled away from him, but immediately bumped into the wall. Sam had trapped me in a corner. He grinned, flashing long yellow teeth. "You want to know the truth, don't you, Brian? The mystery nags at your soul. You've been so good to me, filling this world with intriguing and tasting mysteries. I wanted to give you a little treat in return." He kept his hand out. I still didn't take it. Instead, my hand shot to my iPhone. "Do you really want to call the police?" Sam asked. "I don't think your parents at 2165 Sycamore Park Circle would much appreciate that." "How did you... I know all about you, Brian," the old man said. "I know the apartment where you live. I know the last girl you dated. I know how late you stay up editing your podcast every Thursday." "You don't have a brother, do you?" I slowly got to my feet, iPhone still in my hand, finger hovering over the emergency call button. "I don't want to hurt you," Sam said. "I brought you here as a friend. Besides, you're not even my taste." "I'm not your friend," I said, but my voice was low and weak, barely above a whisper. I wanted to shout, to scream. I wanted to deck the old man with a sucker punch, but all I could do was stand there stiff as a corpse. "I won't." "You won't what?" "I won't tell anyone," I said, putting the iPhone back in my pocket. "I swear." "Very good, Brian. Very good." Sam offered for me to take a seat at his kitchen table, but I stood right where I was. with a clear shot to the front door in case he tried anything. Fine, you can remain there. Sam grabbed the photo album and held it up for me to see its contents. He turned the pages. Creak. At first, I thought someone had scrawled over the photos with a red marker, but then I realized the crimson was part of the photos. Each shot a different angle of the girls lying in a dark forest. They'd been ripped to shreds, limbs torn off, intestines splayed across the dirt. It was like a pack of wolves had killed them. I hunched over, fighting the urge to vomit. They didn't see me coming, Sam said calmly, but they heard me. Out there in the dark, trying to capture my true form on film. I didn't like that. What are you? I stepped back, closer to the exit. They say fear spoils the meat, Sam said, closing his album of horrors. But when you season it like I do, it only gets tastier with time. So as long as no one knows what happened, I feed on the mystery as much as I feed on the flesh. Why them? Why Heather and Alicia? Sam shrugged. They happened to cross my path. I felt something wet in my hands. I had balled my fingers into fists so tightly that my nails dug into my palms. Adrenaline coursed through my veins. You're sick, you know that? You're a sick, perverted old man. Charnel Sam laughed in response. He kept laughing and laughing as if I'd just told him the funniest joke in the universe. His mouth grew wider with each guffaw, eventually becoming so wide it revealed row upon row of teeth within his dark maw. Each row moved independently, like a separate mouth. Sam's laughter turned into an ear-splitting chorus, so loud and discordant, it took me a moment to realize what it was. Cries of agony from countless victims, Heather and Alicia included. I sprinted for the front door, accidentally knocking over a tower of boxes on my way out. Each box contained bones, femurs, ribs, clavicles, skulls, all of them human. I called the cops as soon as I was back in my car, speeding away from Sam's house of horrors. How could I not? That creature had to be stopped. The police descended upon the location within the hour. By then, Sam, his RV, and photo album were gone, but the house was still full of hoarded junk and plenty of bones. According to the FBI team that interviewed me, investigators found the remains of 40 victims inside. They wouldn't tell me who, but all were from missing person cases. When they brought me in for questioning, I told the agents everything I've just told you. They responded by handing me a massive NDA. For some reason, the authorities are keeping a lid on all information regarding Sam, his house, and his connection with any missing persons cases, including Heather and Alicia. They've even scrubbed the internet and forced me to remove all traces of my podcast, Eidolon. I kept asking them why, but the agents never gave me a reason, just some vague crap like it could jeopardize our investigation. There's supposedly a top-secret nationwide manhunt for my biggest fan. Charnel Sam is still out there, somewhere, roaming the highways, looking for his next meal. I've been forced into hiding too, witness protection. The FBI says Sam will never find me or my family here, but I don't believe them. I broke Sam's promise. He'll never let me forget that. But I won't rest until the truth is revealed. Charnel Sam feeds on mystery as much as he feeds on flesh. That's why I've posted this story. I needed to warn you. I needed to warn the world, since the police never will, because Sam's most likely victim is someone who has never heard of him. Don't let that someone be you. And that's the end of the story. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're on YouTube, I'd love it if you'd like the video, maybe leave your thoughts so YouTube will show this video to other people. If you're on Spotify, for example, well, I'd love it if you'd follow for more and let me know your thoughts there too. If you'd like to support this channel even more and support my growing shawarma and pizza addiction, which I've talked about before, then head on over to Patreon, where you can join the other patrons who support this show and its content. And me, and my never-ending quest to eat food. I do love food. If you'd like to come hang out with us, you can do that on Discord. There's links to all of this stuff and more in the description of this episode. So I hope you enjoyed yourself. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.